Spring is in the air, and it's the season for growth and new experiences in your career. Explore the country with rewarding travel assignments through Arias Medical Group. Know a PT? Make a referral and earn up to $1,000. To learn more, call 1-800-340-2619 or visit ariusmedical.com. That's AURUSmedical.com. Rock Tape, more than just a tape company. Rock Tape keeps athletes of all levels moving stronger, longer.
With the world's best kinesiology tape,
topical pain relief,
mobility equipment,
and protective gear.
And now physical therapists can get 20% off their first purchase right now at shop.rocktape.com.
Just use the code PTPINECAST at checkout to get 20% off.
That's shop.rocktape.com.
With the code PTPINECAST for killer savings of 20% off.
Rock Tape, the world's best kinesiology tape.
This is the PT Pinecast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer. Bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pinecast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
Our next guest is the founding director in the Spalding National Running Center, professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation, Harvard Medical School. She is a physical therapist with a PhD in biomechanics. She studies gait mechanics associated with injuries and has developed methods to retrain gait patterns. She's an advocate to returning to footwear that allows our amazing feet to function as they were adapted to. Our next guest on the PT Pinecast is Irene Davis. Irene, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. It's great to be here.
Cool. First question is always the hardest on the show.
The first round is on Owen's Recovery Science. Owen's Recovery Science is a single source
for PTs,
OTs,
ATCs,
DCs,
and other medical professionals
seeking certification
in personalized blood flow restriction rehabilitation training. Find out more and get certified
at owensrecoveryscience.com.
We're not drinking right now because we're at work.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate, but in theory, if you were to be having a drink, what's your drink of choice?
Cabernet.
Cabernet?
Yeah.
All right. I'm a...
That and maybe a little tequila.
Good mix.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
That's the recipe for a great Friday night.
Yeah.
Fun to be here. We are at the Spalding Running Center in Boston because we're paralleled with Next. And, you know, when we found out we were going to be this close, we said, let's come over. I'm a weekend warrior runner to read about stuff that you put out and then to be able to kind of walk through. And you were nice enough to give us a tour of the center and all the cool stuff you have to use to kind of look at runners. The cool thing that I liked was the first thing you showed us, which was a PT having a patient stand on one foot.
Barefoot.
I mean, that's where you start, right?
Exactly.
You were talking about that's where you begin. Where do you start? You advocate for minimalism in footwear with runners.
Well, I do think our feet are pretty amazing. And I think that we don't really appreciate how amazing they are. And it's because we have not really leveraged them the way that we should. So when you put your feet into shoes that constrain them and support them, then the muscles don't have to do what they can do because they've got this external support. And so we start to decondition these feet. And what's unfortunate about that is that the muscles of the feet are very important for normal function of gait and standing and posture. We have developed a foot core paradigm, and we published a paper in BJSM that had over 100,000 downloads. So it really,
wow,
it resonated, and we had no idea it would resonate in that way. What happened was I was at the International Foot and Ankle Society meeting in Lexington, Kentucky, around a fire pit with some bourbon. So, since this is Pintcast, I figured we should talk about that. And I was actually lamenting about the fact that our clinical guidelines for plantar fasciitis do not really talk about foot strength.
Yeah.
And if you look at any other guideline, you look at knee and hip and shoulder, they always talk about strengthening. You know, they talked about ultrasound and taping and night splints and everything else. But I think that we just don't understand that the foot has muscles as well that actually are a lot of them. 26 bones, 33 articulations with 6 degrees of freedom. 4 layers of arch muscles.
Wow.
I mean, and the foot has to function like a spring, like a base of support, like a mobile adapter, a rigid lever. So in order to have all of those functions, that's why it's so complex.
And how quickly must it need to do that
and
when
change.
You're doing something like running?
And change function, right? Throughout a single step is pretty amazing. We basically started to think about this foot kind of like we think about the lumbopelvic core. And it was Pat McKeon and Jay Hertel and I that were sitting talking, and we said, you know, we really should develop this concept of the foot core and talk about, you know, how it has these analogies to the lumbopelvic core. So the foot has these very small muscles with very short moment arms, and they're very much stabilizers. I'm talking about the intrinsic foot muscles, not the extrinsic ones. And very much like the lumbopelvic core muscles that are small and have these, they're deep and they have these small cross-sectional areas, small moment arms, they stabilize so that then the larger muscles can do their job. When you think about the foot, if the intrinsic muscles aren't functioning, then it can't do. The larger muscles, like your posterior tib and your peroneals and even your gastroc and anterior, they don't function as well because you've got a foot that's completely collapsed as you're trying to push off. For that reason, we felt that it was important to highlight how important the core of the foot was to normal foot function. And as a result of that, we have really developed quite a bit this core program, this foot core program. And it's not complicated. It's any physical therapist can do it. Every physical therapist should do it, is my opinion. Because basically what you do and what you saw with this therapist working with this patient is that they basically are doing some doming, which is a short foot exercise where you press your toes down. You don't flex them. You press them because it's really not a long toe flexor exercise. And then you draw the ball of the foot back to the heel and raise the arch. And you hold that. So you're learning to activate your arch. So you do that in standing. Sometimes we start in sitting if someone really can't get it. It's like that abdominal draw-in that sometimes people have a hard time doing. So once they get that, we look at them in standing. Then we do doming and hopping where they've got to hold that arch on 2 feet. Then we do doming and hopping on 1 foot. Then we do doming and hopping off of steps and from step to step to step. And you see how we progress to walking and to running.
But you're not even, and this is something that I think a lot of people need to hear. They don't touch a treadmill until they can do all these things well.
Exactly.
That's great.
That's exactly right. Because why put them on a treadmill where they've got 2.5 times their body weight, 1,000 steps per mile, when they can't do a single landing very well? So our mantra is well-aligned, soft landings. And I think that applies to every sport we could talk about. So basketball or even soccer, anytime you're jumping and landing or running and landing, it's important to be well aligned and it's important to be as soft as possible.
Can we alter gait mechanics? Can we change these things?
We're
talking a little bit about
can.
That before, you know, when people have these patterns and they by the time they come to you, they're hurting and they want to get better, but can we change it?
Yes, I truly believe we can because we have, and we've published a number of papers that have demonstrated that we can change the mechanics and actually that those mechanics persist over the long haul. It's interesting though that you asked that question because the very first time I talked about gait retraining, it was at the World Congress of Biomechanics. I can't remember the year. It was up in Calgary. And I literally got scientific tomatoes thrown at me. I mean, people were, seriously, people.
That's the best phrase, scientific tomatoes.
They basically were saying, you know, these are central pattern generator to generate gait and you can't alter it. It's self-optimized for you and your structure. And, you know, and my thought is if that were the case, then we wouldn't be seeing these injuries that are associated with these mechanics. So it took a while to really get people to think about it. But then I just challenged people and say, I mean, why are you paying for golf lessons?
Right.
And why are you paying for tennis lessons, right? Gait's a little harder because you're only, especially running, you're only on the ground for a quarter of a second. So things have to happen very quickly. And it does take a little bit, sometimes a little more effort in that regard, but it still can be changed. And the other thing that I remember just through my career is people telling me, you know, I used to have these braces and I was towing in and I just really taught myself to toe out, you know? And so I know people have done it even on their own. So with a little guidance from a PT and giving them the appropriate preparation, clearly I think you can change the gait pattern. Now, you've got to have a reason to change it, right? So if somebody has a pattern that has been shown in the literature to be related to injury, then I think you have some justification, and especially if it's prospective evidence, right? So that means that they had it prior to their injury. It's a stronger case for it being related to the injury. So my first part of my career, I really worked hard to try to establish these relationships between abnormal mechanics and injury, because that gives you the justification then to change it. And the people that I think really need to have their gait retrained are those people who not had a knee injury once, kind of calmed down, they cut back, it was really a load issue, right? I do think some are load issues, but the ones that have been through 3 courses of PT and it keeps coming back, they've tried to adjust their load and it doesn't get better, they've had all kinds of different interventions and it doesn't get better, those are the people who have an underlying biomechanics problem. And those are the people that we see at the Spalding National Running Center. I would say the average person is probably in their mid-30s to mid-40s, our average. Now, we have people who are young, we have people who are old, we have top 100 finishers of the Boston Marathon, BAA runners, recreational runners, but on average, they've been through three courses of physical therapy that might include orthotics, might include injections, those kinds of things, and still haven't had resolution of their problem. And so, and they're my favorite patients because a lot of times people have told them, you know, running's just not your thing. I believe running is an activity of daily living, and I think we should consider it that. And I think insurance companies should pay for people to be able to get back to running because you need to be able to run.
Born to run.
Born to run. We are born to run. It is in our genes. But you think about, you've got children, you've got to run after. Terrorists nowadays, you know, yeah, you might have to run away from.
Unfortunately, that's true.
So running is something that you have innate in you. You don't have to learn how to do it. Now, some people take it to a sport and they want to perform even, you know, to a higher level. I think that you can be trained to run better, but you can also be trained to walk better. Right? It's just that walking is not typically used as a sport. I mean, right, it can be, I guess. So I just think differently about running. I think that we are all runners. When someone says, I'm not a runner, I say, yeah, you are. Whether you choose to use it as a sport, but you learn to do it as a child without anybody giving you any instructions.
Yeah. So we talked about strengthening the muscles of that thing, the foot, the
yep,
beginning of it all.
Yeah.
We talked about, can you alter biomechanics? And we decided you could. But what happens when we start to alter things with things like orthotics? Are they good?
Yes.
Are they bad?
Yes. That's a really good question. And anyone who's followed my history, my career, knows that I started out in orthotic research, knows that I was recommending motion control cushion shoes because it was what I was taught. And I truly believed that the foot in some people feet don't have the capacity to tolerate the loads of running, and so they need support. I don't believe that anymore. And it really has been an evolution of thought, really, in thinking about how I treat some other parts of the body. You don't treat a shoulder injury by bracing it forever or a neck.
That's a good point. We'd never do that.
We'd never do those PTs or put a brace on your neck forever. Because what would happen? You wouldn't be able to hold up your neck. Would it help your pain for, you know, initially? Yes. Would it support your neck? Yes. And orthotics do support the feet. But you have muscles that do that. And not only do the muscles support your arch, but they also help to spread your toes. And very few people, I'd like you guys to take your shoes off and see if you can
spread
do this.
I don't know if I can.
Can you spread your toes? You have an abductor hallucis and abductor digitorum minimi that are very important. Abductor hallucis and flexor hallucis are very important in maintaining the medial longitudinal arch.
I'm not taking my shoes off because I'll be embarrassed. I don't think I can do that.
But you can. You can learn to do it. So every patient that comes into our clinic, we assess this and we train it.
I've never looked at that in a patient.
Yeah,
but
you should.
But now, as you're saying that, I'm like, obviously I should be.
I think every PT should treat every patient barefoot. I do. And I think the PT should take their shoes off too. And we do. Lindsay had her shoes on, but sometimes she takes them off. I always take my shoes off when I'm clink. Even when I'm evaluating the patients, first thing I do is I take my shoes off. Because even in patients who have other postural problems, there's a lot of sensory input that comes up from the feet. And you just basically can get more activation, I believe, if you can feel it better. And so, yeah, I think we should all be treating the foot as part of our regimens, and I think we should all be doing it barefoot.
Want to take a quick break to thank our sponsors, Aureus Medical Staffing. You've been around the country. I mean, where have you been a PT? All over.
Well,
Delaware.
Yeah, no, I've been a PT in Delaware. It's actually the place I practiced the most. I've practiced all my career. So became a PT at the University of Florida in 19... I'm going to age myself here, but in 1978. And then I went to Charlottesville, Virginia, and lived and worked at Woodrow Wilson Rehab Center in spinal cord rehab.
Wow.
Yeah, and prosthetics, so something very different. Then I went back to get my master's, and at that time I did home health PT to help support myself. And then I did my PhD and did some home health during that time. And then from my PhD, I went to Delaware. And I practiced. I was adamant about that because I love that part of it.
Yeah, so you've been all over.
Yeah.
Our sponsors, Aureus Medical Staffing, they find PT's jobs wherever they want to do. So short term, like travel assignments and stuff like
perfect,
that. Or if you find something you like, they'll get you in there and keep you there.
Awesome. That sounds great.
They bring me out to these conferences to do these great interviews. So if you are a PT who wants to just go somewhere else for a little while, AureusMedical.com, and Aureus will take care of you and get you hooked up. So now we talked about strengthening the foot. and we've talked about changing the biomechanics and, you know, when orthotics may be good and maybe not for too long. So we have these things that people always ask PTs questions that we like to put on the bottom of our feet a lot. How do you choose footwear then? Because mostly everybody's walking around in footwear.
That's exactly right.
And they always get this question, what's the best shoe for me? And what's the, or a lot of times it's just, what's the best shoe? You know, my response is, I haven't seen your feet yet, or I haven't seen you move. So how do you go about the process of choosing running specific footwear?
I'm going to go back a little bit, about 2 million years.
Okay, just a little bit.
Just a little bit. And this is the when we started to run. So it's the change between Australopithecus and Homo erectus. Australopithecus was our last walking man. Homo erectus was our first running man. And during that period of time, 2 million years ago, our brains were getting bigger. We needed to eat meat. We needed to hunt. Okay. And so this idea of persistence hunting is, and actually there are people in third world countries today that still persistent hunt.
This is a cool theory. Just mention it because I've read about this.
Yes.
I think people should know about it.
It is a theory. It is a theory, but there is persistence hunting still today. And so there were no spears at this time. So we do know that. So the only way they could get their animals is to run them into exhaustion. And the running was not what we're doing today. It's not running a marathon in 26 miles on flat surfaces. You know, it was stopping and starting and running at about a 10 minute per mile pace, 8 to 10, which is kind of like my pace. So it was just very different. But at that time, we were running without anything on our feet. And maybe they put some things on to protect the bottom of their feet. But, you know, we ran that way for at least 2 million years. And if you look at footwear just before the 60s, okay, before the 60s and really before the 70s, footwear was simply something to protect the bottom sole of the foot and something to keep it on your foot. And footwear was there to protect the bottom surface of your foot. And that's what I think, so for 2 million years. And it's only been in the last 5 decades that we've had all of this technology that's been put into shoes and hasn't changed injuries at all. What I'm going to suggest to you is what the fad is. A lot of people think, oh, well, barefoot running and, you know, minimal shoes are the fad. Uh-uh. The fad is all of these things. When you think about in time, we're talking about 50 years versus 2 million years. You know, it's such a small percentage. So I think that what we should be doing is not adapting the foot, but protecting the foot. It's how we wear, why we wear other clothing. You wear a hat to protect you from the sun and from the rain. And there's no other clothing that actually supports you, short of jock straps and bras, maybe, right? But other than that, really, they're there to protect you. And now, of course, we're fashionistas, you know, and sure. So there's all of that. But what happened? How did we get to that point? And so when I was writing an article for the JOSPT, there was a special issue on running in 2014, and I titled it The Reemergence of the Minimal Shoe. I interviewed a gentleman named Jeff Johnson, who I think must be in his 70s at this point, because he was one of the founders of Nike, or he was there early on. He actually came up with a Nike name from what I've been told. And he didn't even have an internet. I think his phone was attached to the wall with a cord. But we talked, and I said, you know, Jeff, I want to know how we ever got to these motion control, stability, and cushion shoes from footwear that simply were like plimsolls, which basically was just like a rubber sole kind of with a canvas upper, and they were running in those shoes. So what he said was, in the 70s with the running boom, they saw this increase in running injuries. And of course, you've got less fit people running, and also it was when the cushion heel came into play at about that same time. When the cushion heel came in, I think people were more tendency towards rear foot striking, because that's been shown as well. But he basically said that they were concerned. Nike was concerned. So they brought 3 sports podiatrists in, Harry Hlavnik, Dixie, and Steve Subotnick. And these 3 sports podiatrists saw a lot of the runners, and they were really well known. And they said, you know, as consultants, they said, we think it's because there's too much impact and too much motion. And that's how it happened.
Wow.
Like, I had no idea. And there's nothing written about this. And this is simply just a communication. But I did put it in the article, and so I cited it that way, just so it's in there. It's a piece of history that we didn't have. So basically, they believed that we needed to cushion the impacts, and we needed to control the foot motion. And that's how it happened. And then they became beefier and beefier and beefier till we had the Brooks Beast.
So some is good, more is better, right?
Right. And now we have 30 to 40 millimeter
Hokas,
and there's a lot of highly cushioned shoes. And they change the way that the lower extremity functions. So Casey Kerrigan, who was the chair of PM&R here for a while and then went to UVA and then she started her own shoe company, but she was looking at different footwear and looking at the torques at the ankle, knee, and hip. And what she showed is the more you put between the foot and the ground, the greater the torques, right? The more abnormal. So your most normal, your gold standard is when you're barefoot. So why not have footwear? This is a long answer to your question, but why not have footwear that actually mimics what the foot does when it's barefoot, which means, and you can't totally mimic it because the minute you put something between the foot and the ground, you lose some sensory input, but at least you're not supporting it and you're not cushioning it. And that, so that's our approach is, you know, I think the evolutionary biologists talk about a mismatch theory and say that our bodies are mismatched now. The bodies that we have are mismatched to our environment, that our environment changed much quicker than our bodies take to adapt. It takes tens and hundreds of thousands of years for those adaptations. The Industrial Revolution only took decades.
Because of what? Because we flatten everything, we pave everything, because we now put shoes on our feet.
Right. Well, I'll talk about it generally, and then I'll talk about footwear. So in general, with the Industrial Revolution, for example, and we were less physical, with less physical labor, our metabolisms didn't change, but our activity levels changed. So we know what's going to happen there. We're going to have obesity. Obesity is associated with cardiovascular disease and even cancers and diabetes. So a lot of the non-communicable diseases, the ones that are preventable, actually the mismatch theory suggests that they're related to the fact that we're not using our bodies the way they're meant to be. So now let's extend it to the foot. Our foot is meant to land, I believe, and my hypothesis is, and it's my working hypothesis, that our feet are, we're meant to land on the ball of our foot when we run, not when we walk. When we walk, we need the heel rocker. Mm-hmm. The heel pad of the foot is dense enough to tolerate the loads of walking. And there's a pressure pain threshold study done where they found that you started to feel pain when you exceed the pressure of walking in your heel. I mean, that tells you that you probably weren't meant to land on it when you run,
right?
So I believe that we were meant to land on the ball of our foot. So I really believe that we're meant to land on the ball of our foot, right? But when you put a shoe on somebody, they immediately change to a rear foot strike. And it's been shown in other studies. I have a video of that's actually supplementary information from a study that I was on with Dan Lieberman. That was that barefoot study that was in Nature.
I cited him in my first year of PT school.
Yep. Yeah. And basically, we show someone who's never put shoes on, and when they land with just barely a 4 foot strike pattern, and then you put a pair of shoes on and they land on their heel. So you can stride out further. You've got more cushioning so you can land on your heel. You can kind of pound the ground into submission. You don't feel it, but guess what? There's an impact peak that you get that you don't get when you land on the ball of your foot.
Because now you're not using the muscles to cushion the blow.
And you know what? That's exactly it, Jimmy. So our bones and our joints are there to give us structure and movement, but not to attenuate loads. It's the muscles that are meant to attenuate loads. So when you land on the ball of your foot, your calf attenuates that load and you get this very smooth ground reaction force. Whereas if you land on your heel, you get an impact. Right, that's a jolt. And what's interesting is when we take people down to the motion, the instrumented treadmill downstairs, and if they have pain, I kind of like it when they have pain because I can modulate it. So we'll have them run in their shoes the way they normally run, and 80% up to 90% in some studies of traditionally shod runners land on their heel. So most of them land on their heel. Then we'll take their shoes off. When they're running in their shoes on their heel, we'll ask for a visual analog scale. And they might say 3 out of 10. Yesterday, it was 5 out of 10. We took their shoes off, had them run on the ball of their foot. This was IT band pain. 0. 0 out of 10. Immediately. And I believe it's because you don't have that jolt. Mm-hmm. That jolt is associated with very high rates of loading. And you cut the rates of loading in half when you get onto the ball of your foot. And it doesn't take a lot. It's just a little lifting of that heel.
Well, we've been described as just a giant spring. You know, every other joint bends in a different direction.
Exactly. Giant spring. And running is spring-like. Walking is modeled as an inverted pendulum. Running is modeled as mass spring. Running is not fast walking. And that's what a lot of people think. Well, it's just, you know, fast walking. And once you get to a certain speed, then you sprint and you're on the ball of your foot. But I really think that if we were all adapted to being barefoot and minimal shoes, that we'd see far less heel striking.
So when you see that spike in load, what are the things that are going to happen up the chain? You're going to get knee pain. You're going to get hip pain.
Right. So we've done some studies looking at impacts and their relationship to injury. And what we found is that people who have, this is retrospective, but a history of tibial stress fractures have greater impact. People who have had patellofemoral pain have greater impacts. People who have plantar fasciitis have greater impacts. And those are just the injuries that we looked at. We chose injuries that were common. We also conducted a prospective study where we looked at people at baseline when they were uninjured and followed them, about 250 runners, followed them for 2 years. And when we looked at who got injured and who did not, there was no difference in impacts. But that was not my interest. My interest was in the people who got injured and sought medical attention. Because again, remember I said that I think that sometimes an injury is just an overuse.
Right.
It's a load issue. I agree with that. But the people who get it either more severely or over and over, it doesn't get better when they cut back and they seek, that those are the people that seek medical attention, they have an underlying biomechanics problem. When we separated those people out and compared them to someone who had never been injured, significantly higher impacts. So again, I think this applies to those people who have these chronic running injuries, and some people can get past them by just adapting their load.
All right, so here's the $1 million question.
Yep.
How do we cure running injuries? How do we fix it?
I think the way that we cure running injuries is that we return back to running the way our bodies were adapted. I don't know that we'll cure them. I think it's maybe silly to think that you'd never have a running injury because there's always going to be other causes, but I think we could significantly reduce the number of running injuries that people sustain if we started out with children, right, and had them basically run in shoes that don't change their foot mechanics, or at least to the least degree. I think that's the way that we actually reduce injuries.
You had mentioned earlier that you have a beginning paradigm that you give out to people to do. Can people find out on your website?
We haven't put that on our website yet. We have a paper that will describe this, this foot strengthening program, and I've actually talked about it in a lot of like PT meetings, and I've given out the program. We just don't have it in print at this point. But basically, we have a study right now that we did in collaboration with Sarah Ridge at Brigham Young University, and we had individuals run in minimal footwear, actually walk. This was a walking study. So gradually increase their steps from 2,500 to 8,000 over the course of 8 weeks. And then another group who went through this foot core strengthening program, which will be published with the paper, and the third group who had no intervention, they were control. And what we found is that there was an increase in muscle size and an increase in strengthening in the people who simply walked in the minimal shoes. There was a greater increase in strengthening in the people who did the strengthening program. But it just goes to show that if you, even just by walking in minimal shoes, that you're going to engage those muscles and they're going to get stronger.
You have to do more.
They have to do more. You increase the demand, and that's how muscles function.
When can we look forward to that?
We're in the process of writing it up. Okay. So, you know, it has to go through the review process, and so maybe a year,
I would say. We'll let people know. That's what we
do. Yeah,
but
we have presented these data at ACSM and also at APTA.
Okay. Last part of our show is the important one. So every episode that we record is a pint, but before we're doing pints, we do shots.
Oh, good.
Not tequila right now.
Okay.
Maybe later.
Okay.
Parting shots of wisdom.
This is the parting shot.
Powered by Optum. Optum offers weekend courses that are Monday morning applicable, utilizing approaches that make sense.
They promote excellence in hands-on treatment, exercise prescription, pain science, and clinical reasoning, offering a COMT,
as well as an APTA accredited fellowship in orthopedic manual therapy, both online and in-person mentoring, with locations in Houston, Dallas, and Scottsdale, Arizona. Find out more online
at optumfellowship.com.
If you were going to leave the field of PT, maybe PTs out there listening who deal with runners, who see runners every day, what would you want them to remember as they're about to treat that next runner?
And a lot of this I've kind of talked about today, but I think that the pearls are, don't forget the feet. Please don't forget the feet. And number two, try to get people out of that footwear and get them adapted to footwear that allows the feet to do exactly what they're meant to do. really truly believe that adapting people to back to a forefoot strike pattern is going to be beneficial. One of the things I didn't talk about is that we actually have a study that is in review right now with Scott Waring, in which we looked at people who are habitual forefoot strikers versus habitual rearfoot strikers and looked at their Achilles tendon stiffness. You talked about having Achilles problems.
Right. I'm all ears now.
And what we found is that the people who are habitual forefoot strikers have stronger, stiffer tendons. And stiffer tendons actually store and return energy to a greater degree. One in two, a 52% lifetime incidence of Achilles tendinopathy in male runners. What would those statistics be if everyone were forefoot strikers and strengthened their tendon? I mean, there are so many reasons that have pointed me in this direction, and it's evidence. That's why I feel very confident in this, because that's my ammunition. That's any scientist's ammunition, is the evidence. If you're having difficulties getting your patients over that hump, maybe try transitioning them to a forefoot strike pattern, but make sure you properly prepare them for that with the foot strengthening and calf strengthening.
Irene Davis, Spalding National Running Center, been really informative. I geek out on this stuff, so I was really excited to come here and
it was a lot of
everything.
Fun.
So thank you for taking time to talk to us. Hope it's not the last time.
I hope so too. All right. Take care, Jimmy.
The PT Pinecast is a product of PT Pinecast LLC.
It is hosted and produced by PT Pinecast CEO Jimmy McKay and CBO Sky Donovan from Marymount University.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it.
This has been another pour from the PT Pinecast.
The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that. Follow us on Twitter, @PTPintcast, and online, @PTPintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all.